that of all the magicians and astrologers that will be found in the whole realm of Nebuchadnezzar. We come now to this last verse in chapter 1, which says, "And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus." Now, what do those words say to you?
Yeah.
Continually?
Yeah.
Yes. Very good. To me it says this, the great claim that is made by the Babylonian system, of course, is that it is there forever. In Revelation chapter 18, when Babylon in the last days looks upon her wealth and her following, she makes a statement which indicates her faith, her confidence in perpetuity. That is, that great power is never ever going to pass away. Verse 7 of Revelation chapter 18, which says, "How much she has glorified herself and lived deliciously, so much torment and sorrow give her, for she saith in her heart, I sit a queen and am no widow and shall see no sorrow." Now, is that not Babylon's claim to being a perpetual kingdom, never passing away? And running ahead just a little bit, when the God of heaven told Nebuchadnezzar that after his kingdom would come another kingdom inferior to his, and then a third kingdom and a fourth kingdom, and finally iron clay in the feet and the toes, and all of this to be supplanted by another kingdom yet, namely God's eternal empire kingdom. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar heard the witness in the image dream, at first, of course, he accepted that, but very, very soon he rebelled against it by erecting an image made entirely of gold. Now, what was the king saying by erecting an image entirely of gold? Right. So the claim put forth by Babylon is that his kingdom will last forever. Now, on the other side, of course, it is God's statement that the only everlasting kingdom is the kingdom which is built by the principles of righteousness. We have been making the point that Daniel is the representative of the righteous kingdom. He lived by the principles of that kingdom. Always and ever, in his life, God was the only problem solver, plan maker, burden bearer, and Daniel enjoyed continual rest as he followed those principles through. Now, if one had been called upon, an average person had been called upon to assess which of these two kingdoms, that is, the one symbolized by Daniel or the one symbolized by Nebuchadnezzar, which of those two would be the more long-lasting? And as one looked back there on the wealth of Babylon and the power of Babylon, and the numbers under Babylon's control on the one side, and the poverty and the smallness of numbers of God's people upon the other side, who would you naturally predict as being the more long-lasting? Babylon. From the human, visible, material point of view, Babylon would be the one that you'd expect to last the longer in this context. But here the scripture tells us in plain terms that it was not Nebuchadnezzar, nor the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar, which was the long-lasting empire. But after Babylon had been reduced to a heap of rubble, its king slain, its armies demolished, its people taken captive, after Babylon utterly ceased forever to be a voice or a power in the world, there was Daniel living on. As the text says, "And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus." Now, this does not mean he died in the first year of King Cyrus, because we don't know when he died. There's no record of his death, which is rather appropriate. But we'd imagine he continued on sometime into the reign of Cyrus and Darius as a very successful statesman in that kingdom. But the point being made here is that he outlived the Babylonian Empire. And we have to recognize, of course, that the experience of Daniel is a type of the experience of the people of God in the last days. Once again, Babylon will straddle and control the entire world. Billions of people will stand under her banner. The monetary might of the world will be at her command. All the treasures of gold and of silver from Egypt and Ethiopia were told in Daniel chapter 11. And every appearance will suggest that she has the power to carry out her plan to obliterate the church of God from off the face of the earth. And she will certainly put forth all her resources to accomplish that objective. But just as Daniel continued beyond the time when Babylon ruled the world, when Babylon was a power at all, beyond the time when Babylon became a heap of rubble, so the true people of God in the last days will continue on beyond the collapse of this final system called Babylon, which of course is Rome and the papacy. Now we know too, of course, that King Cyrus is a type of Jesus Christ. And so Daniel survived right down until the coming of King Cyrus, typical of the fact that those of us under God's leadership as our plan maker and director and so forth enter upon this final battle with the last day king of Babylon. We shall continue until the coming of the great anti-type of Cyrus, who is Jesus Christ himself. And so what may seem and what would be to many, many people as being nothing more than a simple statement of history has in it a very, very deep and wonderful lesson or message for us today. A great assurance, a great certification that God's ways are the only ones which will survive right through until the very end. And so chapter 1 then closes with that comforting word about the perpetuity of God's cause and the invincibility of God's cause. Now we pass to chapter 2. Now chapter 2 is the revelation of a divine plan. Right, we'll now begin to look at this plan. So here we have a divine plan. The objective of that plan was the conversion of King Nebuchadnezzar. So I put down here, conversion of King Nebuchadnezzar. Now the plan, of course, involved workmen. God can never accomplish his work down here in this world unless he is blessed with workmen, and obviously, of course, Daniel and friends were Daniel plus the three. Daniel, of course, in particular, was the workman that God was depending upon to make this plan successful. Now, we read this morning how human effort without divine power is useless, and likewise, divine power can do but very little unless it is in co-workmanship with human efforts. Now the critical secret of success of this plan was total cooperation on the part of the workmen. The plan itself was absolutely faultless because it's not possible for God to make a bad plan, is it? It's just not possible for God to make a bad plan. But it is highly possible, and it has happened all too frequently, that the beautiful plans made by God have been destroyed because the workmen just simply didn't carry them out. Or, worse still, they substituted their own plans in the place of the plans made by God. And the only possible outcome, of course, was total and miserable failure. Now let's meditate upon this for a moment. We just made the observation it's not possible for God to make a bad plan. That's just not possible. Nor was it necessary for God to use or wait through 6,000 years to solve the problem caused by the entrance of sin. Now can you imagine God being so inept or inefficient as to have to stumble down through 6,000 years of repeated mistakes and delays of plans that didn't work out before he could finally solve the problem caused by sin? The answer, very obviously, is God is not that kind of plan maker. Well then, why has there been so long delay? For the very simple reason that the workmen have failed to carry out the plans that God made. There have been times, of course, when they have for a short time. In fact, usually a churchman advises that will for a short time carry out the plan exactly as God made it. And then they'll begin to insert their own plans in the place of God, and then delay of a long or short period, as the case may be, is the inevitable consequence. A good example of this, of course, is the experience of Elijah. Now, just as in Daniel's day, as we'll look at here in just a moment in Daniel chapter 2, in Elijah's day, God had made a plan, which we'll call a divine plan, and the object was the reformation of Israel, and the workman was Elijah. It was a fine plan, requiring something like 3 or 4 years to execute. Now, the first part of the plan called for Elijah to travel down to the court of King Ahab in Samaria or Jezreel, which was in Samaria, and to march into the palace unannounced, past all the guards who didn't even see him, because God hid him from their eyes, and to stand in the presence of the king and tell that king there'd be no rain until he and the people repented. So, under God's personal direction and protection, Elijah marches down to Jezreel, goes to the palace of the king, walks in the door unchallenged, up the steps and into the king's presence, gives his announcement, turns in his head and walks out again. And the startled king, before he wake up to what had happened, found that the messenger of God had disappeared, leaving the king alarmed and bewildered. So far, the plan was working perfectly. Then the plan called for Elijah to sit quietly for several months by the brook, where he was daily fed by the ravens, who brought him food, and the brook provided him with drink. Now, of course, when God's plan calls for inactivity, then God's plan is more difficult to follow. So when that plan calls for activity and doing things, and I suppose those several months when Elijah sat by the brook must have been very, very trying months indeed. Finally, the brook dried up. In the meantime, King Ahab was frantically searching for this man because the rain had stopped falling, the fields were drying up, the cattle had begun to die, and the prospects were not very pleasant at all so far as Israel's economy was concerned. With the drying up of the brook, the plan now called for Elijah to go and stay with the widow of Zarephath. He went and he abode there until the word of God came to him and said, "Now, Elijah, the next step is that you go and confront King Ahab, the priests of Baal, and the multitudes of Israel." And so he went, exactly as God planned. And exactly as God planned, they built those altars. Exactly as God planned, he challenged the priests of Baal. Exactly as God planned, the fire came in and consumed his sacrifice, and the priests of Baal were slain. Then, still working to God's plan, Elijah went up on the mountain to pray for the outpouring of rain, which, as you know, of course, came in due time. Then he ran before the chariot of Ahab down to the gates of Jezreel, where upon arrival he lay down to sleep under the archway of the gate. Now, the interesting thing is this. Up until this point of time, the plan had gone through faultlessly. There had been no hitches, no delays. Everything had gone exactly as God had planned it to go. And now, the whole plan is on the very eve of fruition. If Elijah will now continue to follow God's plan, stand by his post of duty, wait until the morrow, then Jezebel was to suffer an ignominious death, which would so impress Ahab and the people as to generate a mighty reformation in the house of Israel. In other words, the good work begun on Mount Carmel would then roll forward until the whole land had been brought back to God, the idols of Baal destroyed, the sanctuary service restored, and a new day altogether begin in the kingdom of Ahab. Now, the successful fruition, as I read Prophets and Kings, apparently was only hours away. And then in the dead of night, a messenger arouses the weary Elijah and says to him, "A message for you from Queen Jezebel. She says that because of what you've done to her priests of Baal, at this time tomorrow you'll be just like one of them." Now then, this was an unexpected turn in the plan. Elijah hadn't quite anticipated this. He was quite certain that the events of that day would have so impressed the king that Jezebel's power over him would have been entirely broken. But, of course, he was mistaken in this respect, and so he leaped to his feet in alarm. He did not like the prospects of tomorrow. He could not see the fruition of God's plan, so he just threw God's plan away, introduced his own, and he ran as fast as he could from the gates of Jezreel. What was the consequence? Jezebel didn't die, the king was not impressed, and the Great Reformation just simply did not take place. And there was another delay in the carrying forward of the work of God. Now, I'm very impressed with this word delay, because every time that we turn to make plans for God's work, we actually delay the very work we're trying to promote. For instance, consider when the Israelites came to Kadesh Barnea. They could have gone directly into that land. They could have been in that land before the spies returned from their mission of spying out the land. in less than 40 days, they could have been already inside the borders fighting to gain possession of that country. Instead of that, they turned back, and there was a very unnecessary delay of 40 years. And that's quite a stretch of time. But it's very short compared to the delay that was caused by the apostasy of Israel that led to the Babylonian captivity. And then what about the even longer delay that was caused when Paul surrendered to the demands of the leaders in Jerusalem, and the best part of 2,000 years was to go by, not all that much, but getting on toward that, let's say more like, shall we say, 1,500 or 1,600 years, was to go by before the world could be lifted again out of Babylonian darkness and depression. If you sit down and add all these delays up, as far as we can ascertain the length of them, some are quite specific, 40 years back in the days of Israel, and then after Paul's death, at least 1,260 days, and then if you think about the time lost because of the apostasy after David's day, the time lost because of the apostasy after the restoration back to Jerusalem again, it adds up to thousands and thousands of years, and one begins to realize that God could very quickly have finished the work, way back possibly while Adam was still alive, if the people of God had only done the work they ought to have done. And certainly Paul says in Joshua's day, they could have then entered into God's rest, which would mean, of course, that the kingdom of God would be established in this world eternally. Now the whole thing reminds me of a situation such as this one. Now of course I have never heard of this actually happening, and I don't suppose you have either. But let's suppose today that a certain man goes to an architect and asks him to draw up plans for a very, very large office building. It may be, shall we say, 100 stories high or more or less, as the case may be. And the architect prepares those drawings. It takes him months and months of hard work with many, many specialist assistants to aid him in this task. And finally, the whole complicated structure has been put down on paper. A builder is then engaged, who brings along his workmen, and for 3 months or more or less, as the case may be, they build according to the plan. No deviations, no variations. Then one morning, one man comes to work with a drawing board under his arm. Instead of wielding hammer and chisel, he sits down and begins to draw plans for the continuation of that building. Very soon the other workmen join him until the whole team is bowed and concentrating over drawing boards in their earnest desire to plan the future of that building. Now, for a start, of course, every man will draw a different plan. What confusion that makes. And none of them will draw according to the architect's drawings. And none of them will draw a building which will stand up, because none of them have the engineering and scientific knowledge to tell them how big the girders must be, how much steel there must be in the concrete, how thick the concrete must be, what the concrete mix must be. And if the building was built to their plan, in the first good wind, it would all come crashing down around their ears, which would be a rather disastrous outcome, to say the least. Now, if this should happen on a major construction, even a minor construction, would it be tolerated? Absolutely not. Now, what would be the effect of it? It would delay the continued progress of the building, because while those men were engaged in that kind of work, they would not be building the building as they should be. Secondly, whatever construction they did manage to achieve according to their plans would have to be torn down. And thirdly, it would take time to find and organize another team. Now, if they in turn would have followed through the same procedures, and the next team likewise, what would be the prospect of that building ever getting finished? None. Now, that doesn't happen in worldly construction, fortunately, but it does happen, or it has happened, in the work of God. Right back there in the beginning, God made a perfect plan whereby the work could be very, very quickly finished. He called together a team of workmen. Let's come down, for instance, to Moses' day, when God had a perfect plan for their departure from Egypt and their entering the promised land, all to be done in about 2 or 3 years at the outside. At first, as we know, the Israelites very, very faithfully obeyed the commands of God and carried out his plan to the very letter. With the result, they had a most successful exodus from the land of Egypt. They crossed the Red Sea, they built the sanctuary, they came down to Kadesh Barnea, and then Instead of waiting upon God for His further plans and details, they took out their own plan-making facilities and made their own plans in the place of God. And there was a delay. Gideon through history has been that same way over and over and over again. But here in Babylon was a man who did not do that. And the divine plan to effect the conversion of the king Nebuchadnezzar moved forward with perfect success, because Daniel absolutely refused, in any sense of the word, to be plan maker in the place of God. To him, Christ was the only head of every man in the church of God. Now, the plan involved, of course, God coming to Nebuchadnezzar in an area that was very sensitive to the king. Well, I guess there were two areas that were sensitive to the king. One was Babylon's capacity, and the other was Babylon's future. Now, what do I mean by Babylon's capacity? Well, Babylon claimed that she had in herself the power to solve all problems, the power to rule the world, the power to build a kingdom of light and glory that would last forever and ever. And so, right on that ground, God would bring a challenge to the king by bringing to him a problem which he would find to be quite insoluble so far as Babylon's capacities were concerned. And this problem, to make things more interesting and more urgent to the king, would be in the realm of dreams. Now, the Babylonian king back in those days was very, very impressed by dreams. They regarded dreams as being a sure and certain message from the gods. And so if he had a dream, he always had to have the interpretation of that particular dream. So God's plan then was very, very skillfully laid, very skillfully laid, and came to the king in those areas where above all else the king was most sensitive. So we read now in chapter 2 and verse 1 the beginnings of God's plan. And I'd like to emphasize the fact that at this point of time, Daniel was absolutely oblivious to what God was intending and to how God would carry out his intention. In other words, God did not come to Daniel and say, "Now look, Daniel, I want to bring about the conversion of the king of Babylon, and I'm working up a plan here. I'd like you to be privy to it and know all about it, so when things began to happen, you'll know just what's going on." God didn't do that. God simply made the plan, put it into operation, told Daniel nothing about this, and Daniel did not become aware of the events transpiring until quite some time after the king had dreamed his dream. Now we read chapter 2 and verse 1. "And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep brake from him. Then the king commanded to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans for to show the king his dreams, and they came and stood before the king." Now we know, of course, that while Daniel was classed as a magician, in fact in Daniel chapter 6 he is called the master of the magicians, he was not called to the king at this point of time to offer a revelation of the dream and the interpretation of that dream. Now one would think the man like Nebuchadnezzar would be concerned to have only the very best of counselors to come to him in an hour of such urgent crisis as this one. You think that. But the king did not call Daniel and his three friends in this hour of need and crisis. Now what was the king saying when he called the magicians that did not call Daniel? Right? Again? Right? He didn't need Israel. He solved his own problems, but he was demonstrating his faith in the Babylonian system. He was going to war against God. He was saying, "Lord, I don't even consider that the smartest people in your kingdom can compare with the power of Babylon in a situation like this. The magicians, they will do it. They will tell me the dream. They will make known the interpretation of that dream to me. I have no fear nor concern in this matter whatsoever." And so thereby the king was taking a position, or taking up a position, just as armies do in warfare, and he was now placed in head-on conflict with the God of heaven. Now very quickly the king was to learn that he was a situation that was beyond the capacity of Babylon. Babylon's limitations had been reached and her inefficiency was being exposed at this point of time.
We come to verse 3, Daniel chapter 2.
And the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans, the king of Syriac, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation thereof, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. But if you show the dream and the interpretation thereof, you shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. Now then, the Chaldeans came making a confession. It surprises me they didn't at least in some way try to conceal their inefficiency by making some kind of pretense to the king that they could tell the king what he dreamed and what the interpretation of that dream was. But they knew perfectly well that they did not dare to volunteer some kind of dream. They could guess, I suppose, very hard and say, well, the dream could have been this or that. What does the king usually dream? What's the general direction of his dreaming? Which they would know perfectly well. But they knew that sometime, sooner or later, that king would remember what the dream was, and if his memory did not tally with their statement, then what was going to happen to them? They'd be killed. And so therefore it was most important to them that they do not venture out onto a limb, so to speak, and expose themselves to destruction. So they did the only other wise and proper thing. They said to the king, look, king, you're asking just a little bit too much. You tell the dream, and we'll tell the interpretation. But you're asking too much to expect us to tell the dream as well. We do not know what you dream. We cannot know what you dream. Now, as we move on, we'll see how far they took this confession. And without question, of course, it must have upset the king something terribly. Because the last thing he ever wanted was a confession, an admission on the part of the Babylonian system that it was not able to meet and solve every possible problem. Now, after the king with dire threats and in great anger ordered them to tell the dream and the interpretation, they came back with the same answer in verse 7. They answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream and we will show the interpretation of it. The king answered and said, I know of certainty that you would gain the time because you see the thing is gone from me. But if you will not make known to me the dream, there is but one decree for you, for you have prepared lying and crop words to speak before me till the time be changed. Therefore tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me the interpretation thereof. Now then, I thought that these Chaldeans had been very truthful, didn't you? Have they been very truthful? Absolutely. But the king said, you have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed. Now, what was the nature of the king's accusation in this respect? The nature of the accusation was that it was not it was not in this direct conversation they had spoken lying and corrupt words. But prior to this, they had spoken lying and corrupt words in that they had taught, being the great teachers, of course, in the land, that the Babylonian system was infallible, it was self-sufficient, it was complete, it would never be superseded, and it needed nothing else outside of it to supply its every need. That is what they had been telling the king. Now they're admitting that when they told that to the king, they were liars, weren't they? The king was sharp. He was no fool, as we say, a man of great education and great intellectual power, and the king perceived that their presence admissions gave the lie to their previous claims. Now, of course, he was angry not just with them, but he was angry because here in the very city where the Church of God was now resident under the person of Daniel and his three friends, the weakness of Babylon was about to be exposed. To the king, this is something new and startling, because up until this point of time, apart from the issue over the meat and the wine and over the examination, which he dismissed as being nothing anyway, but up until this time, Babylon had known nothing but victory, victory, victory. Until this time, there had never been a problem which they could not solve, either by cutting somebody's head off or by some other means, as the case may be. But now, suddenly, the king is confronted by something for which Babylon is completely unable to supply an answer. It's something new, something frightening, something the king didn't want to have in his kingdom, something which he no doubt hoped would just simply pack its bags and quietly steal away and be a bad dream in itself. Nothing more than that. But it wasn't a bad dream. It was a bad reality. It was something that he could not deny, something which now, as never before, he desired to have solved. It seemed as if the very future of Babylon depended upon this thing being revealed to him. Now comes the answer from the Chaldeans, which I value very much because this is one of the most striking confessions ever made by Satan's children. Verse 10 and 11. The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, "There is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asketh such things of any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. And it is a rare thing that the king requires, and there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh." Those men admitted that day the real nature of the Babylonian system. We'll go back now to the mystery of God. Here is God, the source of all light and knowledge. Here is Jesus Christ, the great connector between the source and the receiver. And last of all, of course, there is man, and he is the receiver. In the Babylonian system, we have God. Of course, he's given various names, and he likewise is recognized in a certain sense as being a source. But then next of all, we have Satan, in the place of Jesus Christ, who professes to be the connector. And last of all, we have the people down here. Now, whereas in the case of the Christian God, there is a connector through whom the secrets of God can be opened up to the human mind, in the Babylonian system, there is no such connector. And therefore, whatever knowledge or light is in God is inaccessible to the people. And so those Babylonians said, "Now look, there is a God in heaven. He knows what that dream was. And he could tell you what that dream was. But unfortunately, O king, there is no connector between him and us. We are totally isolated from him. And because we are isolated from him, there's not a possibility in the world of you ever learning through the Babylonian system what your dream was." Now that was some confession, wasn't it? Some admission on their part. A tremendous admission. And it was not the kind of talk that Nebuchadnezzar wanted to hear, even though it was true. He didn't want to hear that kind of talk. And, being a Babylonian, of course, he naturally resorted to Babylonian tactics to get rid of that unwelcome admission on their part. He decided to kill them. Now, of course, killing them was not going to change the truth of what they said. No hope. The same as when you break a thermometer, you don't change the temperature of the day, do you? Just as hot. You might think it's not so hot, but it's just as hot as it was before. We might mention, of course, that if we go across to 1 John chapter 4, where we are given the test that differentiates Christ from Antichrist, we're plainly told that the mark of Antichrist is a teaching that God in Christ did not come down into human flesh. Now, I've had people, Seventh-day Adventist ministers, in fact, tell me that this test is not applicable to us at the present time. It was a special situation which John confronted back there in his day, and therefore does not have the same meaning at the present time. If I ask you the simple question, is the spirit of Antichrist confined to our day? Is it? No, it's not. The spirit of Antichrist again when? Up in heaven, Lucifer rebelled against the government of God. And that same spirit has manifested itself again and again down through the ages, and that spirit never changes. It's the same spirit in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, as in the days of John, as in our own day. It has the same limitation. It has the same construction. Always it's a creature in the place of the Creator. It's man in the place of God. It is Babylon, and that's the Babylonian system. And therefore, back in the days of Daniel, the magicians there were led to admit to King Nebuchadnezzar to plainly tell him just what their doctrine of the incarnation was. And that doctrine was, of course, that God did not dwell with human flesh. Just didn't. And because of that, There is no communication between God, the source, and man, the receiver. And therefore they told the king, there's no possibility in the world of your learning just what your dream was and the interpretation thereof. Now, I wonder if those magicians realized or believed or knew that Daniel did have a connection with the God of God. If they did, of course, they're not about to admit it. I think they would rather have died themselves than to have made that admission. They did not say to the king, well, try Daniel, did they? That would have been a very humbling thing for them to do, and I think they'd rather die than to make that kind of admission. Now, King Nebuchadnezzar was a bit of a lion. He apparently had a tremendous temper. After all, he fed heavily on red meat and red wine, and that's a very bad combination if you're looking for a placid nature, isn't it? A very bad combination. And so when the king heard this from those magicians, it says in verse 12, for this cause the king was angry and very furious, and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. So now the king thought to get rid of the unpleasant truth by getting rid of those who told the truth. A device, of course, which doesn't work, but at least he was able to vent his anger in this respect. And yet, strangely enough, even though the king did not realize it, he was ordering a symbolic act, because he was Babylon destroying Babylon. The Babylonian king was destroying the Babylonian priesthood. And of these two, the king and the priest, who was the real spring or origin of the Babylonian system, the king or the priest? Priest was, right? So now, just as in the last days, the kings of this earth will be the people will make up the kingdoms of the world, will destroy the priests or the ministers before they destroy each other. So back there, the kingly power reached out to destroy the other side of Babylon, the priest side of the picture. Now Nebuchadnezzar, now, without knowing it, was actually symbolically acknowledging the truth of the words of those magicians. Because those magicians said to the king, in effect, this is Babylon's limit, and therefore in any area beyond this point that Babylon may venture or be taken, as circumstances may arise, Babylon is not safe and destruction awaits her. And so, when the king ordered the execution of those men who could not tell his dream and the interpretation thereof, he was symbolically revealing the ultimate fate of Babylon, which is self-destruction. You see that? Self-destruction. And so they went away, and Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, sought out Daniel and his friends to slay them too, even though they had not been involved in this drama in any sense of the word whatsoever. Satan, of course, trying to pervert God's plan from a plan of salvation to a plan of destruction. He thought he saw an opportunity to effect the death of the Church of God in that place and at that time. And of course, Satan would have been successful if Daniel had not known who his problem solver was and left the matter completely and totally in the hands of that great problem solver.